comment some more. Your prospectuses are due today. Either give them to your TA or leave them down in front here. Either one is fine. And Jim or Carl, do you have any announcements? We will do a couple of review sessions for the midterm, and they probably will be on Thursday afternoon, Friday, or Monday. So I think Jim will announce those on Thursday, probably. We have to agree on some times. Well, that's okay, because that's an open book. That's an open book exam, the take-home part. We'll be handing out a take-home part of the exam on Thursday, and you'll have till Tuesday to do that. And we can we'll do a review, several review sessions. But the take-home part, you can it's open book. You can talk with each other about it. You can. I don't actually want you to write it together. I'd like you to work on it individually in terms of the writing, but you can certainly discuss the issues together if you want to. Okay, let's jump right into our topic. I'd like to draw some broad, large-scale contrasts between the way Plato tended to view history. To some extent, this could be generalized more broadly towards Greek thinking about history, but I'll focus specifically on Plato, and the way Israel or the Hebrews tended to view history. And then I'd like to look at some specific texts from the Jewish scriptures to make these points somewhat more specifically. In the first place, and these are generalizations of a rather large scale, but I hope not irresponsibly so. It's always hard to make this kind of generalizations because there are some exceptions you usually can find. But they're useful in terms of trying to get a broad scale view of different ways of thinking. In the first place, Plato tended to see history as cyclical. That is, history repeated itself. You had various images of the great wheel that turned, and every so many years, 25,000 years perhaps, everything repeated itself. History was not did not have a beginning and an end, but was an endless repetition of the same events, cyclical. Secondly, Plato tended to think of the real and the eternal as above history. What was ultimately real, the forms or ideas of Platonic philosophy, were not involved in the flux and flow of time. They were not involved in decay of the material, but they stood above and beyond history. The eternal ideas or forms of Platonic philosophy. And for Plato, in the third place, the truth, or what was seen as ultimate reality, the good with a capital G, perhaps even God, was known essentially through a kind of contemplation. It was a kind of intellectual, contemplative relationship to reality. You know the truth, you know what is ultimately real, in essentially an intellectual modality through contemplation. And the emphasis for Plato and for much of Greek philosophy was on knowing the truth, to have an intellectual grasp of what was true. Now let me contrast this briefly with the way the ancient Hebrews viewed history. And once again, I make the point that I use the term Israelite or Hebrew deliberately because the terms Jew and Judaism and so on did not appear till much later, till sometime after the exile. So I use the terms trying to be accurate historically. The Hebrews saw history as linear, as a line. It moves towards an end. It's purposive. It has a specific beginning in God's creative act and moves towards its fulfillment in the kingdom of God, and it has a change that is involved in history that is real. And the real and the eternal, that is God for the Hebrew, enters into history. God makes himself known through the specific events of history as a mode of revelation. And thirdly, for the Hebrew, knowledge of the truth, that is, of God, comes not mainly through contemplation, but through God's self-revelation in history. Truth is not known mainly by an intellectual act, by sitting by yourself or with others and trying to contemplate or think about or grasp what is ultimately real. What is ultimately real, namely God, for the Hebrew, reveals himself, makes himself known in history. And usually this takes the form in the Jewish scriptures of what we might refer to as call and response. God addresses his people. They are to respond in obedience to him. And one of the most fascinating emphasis that I think in Judaism is the emphasis not just upon knowing the truth, but upon doing the truth. In fact, that very phrase, doing the truth, would have sounded rather odd in some ways to the Greeks. Truth was essentially an intellectual affair. But for the Hebrew mentality, truth was not fully present until one actually did the truth. You recall the other day I told the story of Uriah the Hittite, of King David and Bathsheba, and Nathan the prophet, how Nathan confronted the king with the truth of what he had done, and David repented of his actions and so on. It was not just enough to know what was right, it was demanded that people do what was right. I didn't have time then, but I should have gone on to point out why I saw that story as so incredibly important, was because I think it so beautifully illustrates the perennial, pervasive, intense concern of Judaism for justice. Judaism has, as much as any religion in the world, emphasized the importance of right relations or of just relations among people, and included in the sphere of justice not just the native-born citizen, but even foreigners and others who in many cultures were not the recipients of impartial justice. But let me get back to these two views of history. For the Greek, history was never much more than a symbol or shadow of true reality. I'm referring specifically here to Plato. Whereas for the Hebrew, time itself is God's creation, and history is the medium of his self-disclosure. It is in the realm of history, according to the Hebrew way of thinking, that we find the most significant clues to the meaning of our own existence. Now take these sheets that we've handed out, these worksheets, and look at the first passage on the sheet. Is the first passage I think you have is Deuteronomy 26. Turn to that and take just a minute to read through the passage. I need a copy of that worksheet so I can follow it as you have it. Just take a minute to read through it. Okay, the Germans have an expression, Sitz im Leben, the life setting, the actual context or situation of a piece of literature, of a writing. As you read through this, what was happening here? What was the life setting, the Zitz and Laban? Jim, would you use the, and Carl, the mics there? Because I want to get a little bit of response on this. What was happening here? What was the life setting of this passage? Anyone, just make a stab at it. What was happening in this passage? It presupposes a specific context or situation. Okay, John says the Exodus. Okay. More specific, yes.
I was going to say the Exodus, but also just, it seems like what God's saying to them is kind of a promise of what's going to happen in directions, like once they get to the land of, you know, Canaan, of the milk and honey or whatever, directions what to do there.
Okay, you see, I think in the first verse there, when you come into the land which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance and have taken possession of it, this is after the Exodus, a part of the Exodus, you might say, and live in it, then they have instructions as to what they are to do. So the situation is, their situation is they come into the promised land. These are some things they are supposed to do. How would you, what are they supposed to do when they get there? It says, you shall take some of the first of all the fruit of the ground which you harvest from your land that the Lord God gives you, and you shall put it in a basket, and so on. It's a sacrifice, it's a time of offering, it's a time of worship. And then the passage goes on and says, and you shall go to the priest who is in office at that time and say to him, and then you have several verses as to what they're to do. They're supposed to say to the priest, I declare this day to the Lord your God that I have come into the land which the Lord swore to our fathers to give us. Then the priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord your God, and you shall make response before the Lord your God. And how would you characterize the next three or four verses there? How would you describe the response that the worshiper is to make? Yes?
Dr. Baer, I think God is instructing them to take some of their bounty and to show thanksgiving.
Okay.
A kind of a nonviolent form of sacrifice.
Okay. Yes? I think that's the larger context here, clearly. The response itself, in starting in verse 5b, a wandering Aramean. How would you describe that? Yes. Jim?
A wandering Aramean is Joseph who went to Egypt and and settled there.
Mm-hmm.
It describes the oppression that the Israelites went through when they were in Egypt. And once they get to the land of milk and honey, they are to make the response to remember who they were before they came to the land of milk and honey.
Okay.
Never to forget it.
Okay.
It's part of the Thanksgiving.
Okay, it's a kind of very simple narrative. Think of Howard Wass's emphasis on story, that we have a kind of life story. This is a kind of encapsulated account or story of the life of Israel. They were slaves, they were oppressed, they cried out to the Lord their God, and he delivered them. What's the grammatical mood of the passage? It's indicative. It's narrative is indicative, as over against imperative and interrogatory and so on. Look at the next passage, Deuteronomy 6, 20 through 25. Just read that quickly to yourselves. Okay, what's the Zitzim Laban, the life setting of this passage? What's the context? What's the occasion for this passage? Anyone? Pardon? The Mosaic Covenant. Okay, any others? What's happening? What's the occasion for the instruction here? Leah? Pardon? Yes. Okay. Can you describe it more in detail? Okay, notice the very first verse again gives you the clue. When your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the ordinances which the Lord our God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son. This is an occasion for the passing on of the tradition. The new generation doesn't understand why the parents observe these particular ordinances, why they worship in this way, why they do these various rites they do as a part of their worship. The son says, what does it all mean? Why do we do this? And the father is instructed to say to his son, and then you have the rest of the passage, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and so on. Notice again, it's a simple narrative, a kind of encapsulated history of the people of Israel. Look at the next passage, Joshua 24, 1 through 3. Here the Zitzan, Melissa. We need about 2 weeks to... The covenant, there are different forms of the covenant in the Jewish scriptures. We sometimes refer to the Davidic covenant or the Abrahamic covenant. Actually, we sometimes also the Noahic covenant and the Mosaic. I'll go on and say a little more specifically about the Mosaic covenant because I want to give an interpretation of it and show the different kinds of covenants. But these were so-called agreements or contracts almost between God and Israel. But let me come to that as the lecture goes on, Melissa. Okay, notice in the Joshua passage, this is also a very important time in the life of Israel. Joshua is by this time an old man. It's about the time he senses he's going to die, and he's ready to pass on the authority over Israel, the leadership, you might say, to his successors. It's a time of transition, of the giving of rule or authority, in a sense, to those who would follow him. Notice Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and summoned the elders, the heads, the judges, and the officers of Israel, and they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all the people, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, your fathers lived of old beyond the Euphrates, and so on. Now notice here the encapsulated history goes even further back. It goes all the way back to Abraham, before they went down into Egypt, before they were enslaved in Egypt. Then it talks about slavery in Egypt, and it talks about the deliverance from bondage to the Egyptians. Now, look at verse 14 in the Joshua passage. Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. How does this one verse differ grammatically from the larger passages? This is in the imperative mood. This is a command, as over against the indicative or narrative of the earlier passages. Notice also the following passage, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, from Deuteronomy 5:6. Who knows what passage that is? How do we refer to that? What is that? Anyone? Yes. No. This is the preface to the Decalogue. This is the introduction to the Ten Commandments. And it's a very, very important verse to note. I want to comment specifically on the relationship between the preface to the Decalogue and the Decalogue itself, or the Ten Commandments. But first, let me say just a little more about the larger passages we've looked at. When the ancient Hebrew wanted to talk about God, he told what God had done in history. And these passages that we've read are not abstract. They are not philosophical. They are not particularly metaphysical or speculative. Rather, they refer to specific historical events in the past history of the people of Israel. These are stories in the Hauerwas sense, and that's, of course, part of where Hauerwas gets his material from. He's trying to be authentic and honestly reflect the tradition of which he's in a part, which includes the Christian Old Testament or the Jewish scriptures. George Ernest Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, in his interesting little book, God Who Acts, and I've drawn many of these ideas from George Ernest Wright's book, George Ernest Wright maintains that for the ancient Hebrews, the recounting of the events associated with the Exodus from Egypt constituted the central religious act of the worshiping community. He says the recounting of the events associated with the Exodus from Egypt constituted the central religious act of the worshiping community. Instead of telling about God in the abstract language of metaphysics or philosophy, they told what they believed God had done in their own past history. This is what George Ernest Wright refers to as a theology of recital, a recital of what he calls the redemptive acts of God in history. And history itself was seen as the chief medium of revelation. This is a very different way of approaching reality from an essentially philosophical, speculative mode, where reason itself, thinking about the nature of reality, tries to come up with ultimate categories. For the ancient Hebrew, history, the very realm that Plato thought of as flux and change and decay and as obscuring reality, the ultimate reality in the more contemplative mode, was seen beyond history, the eternal forms or ideas. For the ancient Hebrew, history itself was the chief medium of revelation. Now, in each of the passages that we looked at from Deuteronomy and Joshua, we have, according to G. Ernest Wright, what we might refer to as event. Let me write this out. I think this is worth getting exactly. He says we have the event, and this would be the enslavement by the Egyptians and the Exodus itself and the coming into the promised land, plus the interpretation of the event, including the implications. And I think we see this as clearly as any place in the Joshua 24, verse 14. You have the event, it's interpreted, and then the implications. Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve Him in sincerity. Let's come back to the Deuteronomy passage, the preface to the Ten Commandments, because it would seem to me that the preface to the Ten Commandments is absolutely essential for understanding the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments themselves. And it's of interest to me that often people will recite the Ten Commandments from Judaism, not recite the preface, and I think that makes it almost impossible to understand how they potentially functioned in the life of the people. The preface is important because in the way of thinking of the ancient Hebrews, the emphasis was not on keeping the commandments as such. That was not primary. The primary emphasis was on what God had done. God's action preceded human response. God's action in delivering His people from slavery to Pharaoh made possible a different way of living. God did not choose Israel because of her special virtue or goodness. One of the texts suggests that she was the least of all nations, but he chose her because of his love for Israel. Now let's try to interpret that. It seems to me that this focus on the indicative preceding the imperative is utterly essential for understanding what's going on both in ancient Judaism and in Christianity. Let's try to paraphrase those texts a little bit. I think what is happening in the Decalogue, for instance, is something like this. It's as if God is saying, inasmuch as I am the Lord your God who loved you and was concerned for justice and heard your cries, was aware of your suffering, inasmuch as I delivered you from bondage to Pharaoh, I liberated you from slavery to the Egyptians, inasmuch as I protected you through the perilous journey through to the promised land and helped you win the new land, inasmuch as all of this is the case, now this is how you ought to live in response to these realities. And then follow the Ten Commandments themselves. You shall have no other gods before me, and so on. The Ten Commandments themselves, according to this way of thinking, are clearly secondary to God's action. And I would even suggest that it is possible to view the Ten Commandments or the Decalogue as a kind of statement of freedom, rather than seeing them mainly as a legal code, which clearly they are. It is possible to see them as a kind of Magna Carta, describing the kind of life that is possible for those whom God has delivered from slavery. That is, it is no longer necessary to worship other gods. It is no longer necessary to steal and lie and slander and covet your neighbor's possessions. If God is the source of your life, then it is possible to live in a new way. It is possible to live with justice towards your neighbor. Tie in the Reinhold Niebuhr analysis. It is not necessary to secure your own future and involve yourself in oppression and injustice. So that the Ten Commandments, understood in this way, are not the primary reality for the religion of Israel. They are the statement of the kind of life that is possible in a world where God delivers one from slavery. They are a kind of Magna Carta. It is not as if one keeps the Ten Commandments and thereby wins God's favor. It is exactly the opposite. Because God has shown his favor to Israel, it is now possible in grateful response to keep the Ten Commandments. So that the moral life is secondary to the reality of God's love. Now this is very close to what Iris Murdoch is saying in a secular context. She's saying that vision precedes choice and freedom. That how you see the world is utterly essential to how you live in it. That if you see the world in such a way that it is constantly necessary to justify yourself, to compensate for your own insecurity through your grabbing of resources and through your using of people, if you see the world in that way, you will act in certain ways. But if you see the world in a different way, There's a possibility, says Murdoch, of engaging in a kind of unselfing and being overwhelmed with a vision of the goodness and beauty and so on of the world about us. This is very, very similar to what we're talking about here. And I stress this because this relationship between the indicative and the imperative, I think, has been one of the most fundamentally creative ideas in Western culture. It has probably had more to do with the shape and flavor of Western culture than almost any other single idea. Let me give just a single example. Almost all of modern psychotherapy and counseling represents a kind of secularization of this relationship between the imperative and the indicative. The counselor does not first say to the person who comes to her grieving and all mixed up and tormented with various personal problems, "Well, get it all straightened out and then I'll talk to you." Or, "Try a little harder and see if you just can't become a better person and then I'll help you sort out your priorities." The counselor relates to the other person initially in a modality of acceptance. Doesn't initially judge the other person or condemn the other person or give lots of free advice. In most forms of counseling, there are exceptions, the counselor simply is open to the person with a problem, and as this person experiences the acceptance and love and concern, it becomes possible for him or her to begin to have enough security to deal with the problems that are at issue. And that is a kind of radical secularization of this relationship between the indicative and the imperative. Almost all good parenting represents this kind of relationship. The parent ideally does not first put demands on the child. You know, "Shape up, you little monster, and get going. Do this and that, and if you're really good, I'll love you. And maybe even give you some lunch and dinner." Obviously absurd. The parent, and clearly you see this already in the animal world, the parent surrounds the child with security and love and acceptance, ideally. And in this relationship of love and acceptance, the child is free to be curious, to learn about the world about her, to reach out to others, to learn. Whereas if the child is constantly feeling that he's not accepted, that love is conditional, that he has to perform in a certain way in order to have love and respect and care, the psychological dynamics are totally different. The child raised in a healthy home does not constantly feel on trial, does not constantly feel that he needs to prove himself, and he does not have to establish his own worth to others or to himself, because it is so patently obvious to such a child that he is loved and accepted and valuable, that forms the fiber and flavor of his or her emotional life. That's very, very close to what the writers here are talking about, that the indicative precedes the imperative. In Christian terms, gospel precedes law, vision precedes the moral demand. What this means then is that in the Jewish scriptures, the focus of attention, and this is also true, we shall see on Thursday, of the early Christian scriptures, the focus of attention is on the objectivity of God's historical acts and not on the subjectivity of inner emotional, mystical experience. Those also form part of the tradition, but always in a secondary way. The priority is given to God's action. God takes the initiative. Humans respond. Now, What about the conditional forms of the covenant? This represents a kind of unconditional form of the covenant that we see in the Abrahamic covenant, in the Davidic covenant. What about the forms of the covenant in the Jewish scriptures that are conditional? If you do so and so, then I will bless you. There are many passages in the Jewish scriptures that take quite a different form. They're not unconditional. They do not start with God's action and unconditional love. They start with a statement such as, if you are obedient, if you serve the Lord faithfully, and so on, then I will bless you. Don't those seem to contradict what I have said in this earlier part of the lecture? Doesn't there seem to be an inevitable tension between these two? And as I was thinking about that last night and spent some time on the phone with a good friend who teaches Old Testament at a seminary out in the Midwest, several things became clearer to me. It seems to me that it is not necessary to see the conditional form of the covenant as fundamentally contradictory to the unconditional form, and my reasoning would be something like this. I think the two ways of speaking represent two levels of human experience. Let me take an analogy from the New Testament, from the early Christian writings. Jesus says on a number of occasions, unless you forgive others, God will not forgive you. Your forgiving others seems to be a precondition for God forgiving you. And that sounds as if you're earning God's love or forgiveness. But I think it's possible, at least, to see those texts or the conditional form of the covenant in a somewhat different way. Namely, they represent a kind of psychological reflection on how our minds work. If you do not forgive others, you are somehow thereby declaring that you don't really believe in forgiveness. You are closing yourself off from this kind of possibility, and that closes you off as well from receiving God's forgiveness in your own life. This is why in interpersonal relations, resentment and bitterness and holding a grudge is usually so devastating. People who are resentful, who have a grudge, who can never forgive someone else, psychologically tend to be people who close themselves off from receiving affirmation and forgiveness and so on. It's almost as if when you do not forgive others, you have a kind of lead shield around you that shields you or keeps away God's forgiveness of you. And I think the conditional form of the covenant is another way of approaching the same reality, that if you do not follow in the ways of Torah, in the ways of the commandments, if you are not obedient to the ways of God as the ancient Hebrew saw it, you put a shield between you and the Lord's blessing. God can't break through the shield because he respects your freedom. He will not override your choice and your freedom. If you seek to close yourself off from his blessing, you will not be blessed. So that the conditional form of the covenant, in my judgment, represents a kind of statement of the psychological dynamics of the relationship between human beings and God, whereas the unconditional form represents more of a theological statement. Namely, the belief that God's love is always primary, that vision precedes moral choice and decision, that how you view the world precedes the way it is possible to live in it. This would be another way of expressing the kind of insight that some theologians have pointed to when they say that God's judgment is not antithetical to his love, but is a manifestation of his love. So that just as the parent who says no to the child, who wants to run out into the street or who wants to grab the detergent and drink it or something like that, the no is not antithetical to the parent's yes. It is not opposite to the parent's love, but is a way of expressing that love. So that God's no or his judgment upon Israel is not because he hates Israel, but because it is another way of trying to call Israel to responsibility when she has been disobedient to God's commandments. Now, this isn't altogether satisfactory for me as a way of interpretation, but I think it's a possibility of bringing those two together. The other question that was raised 2 or 3 years ago by one of my TAs, Roger Badham, was the question, is this way of viewing the covenant, where the indicative precedes the imperative, is this mainly a Christian or also a Jewish interpretation of the materials? And I would say that it tends to be more the latter, but not exclusively so. There are a number of Jewish writers who have touched on some of these issues. I think of John Levinson in his book Sinai and Zion, but there are others as well who give a similar type of interpretation of the covenant, emphasizing the priority of the indicative over the imperative. Christians clearly have preferred that interpretation of the covenant to the more conditional form, although both have been part of the tradition. And on Thursday, I'm going to try to show how some of these same motifs are present in a writing like St. Paul's letter to the Galatians. We have about 5 minutes, and I wonder if there are any questions or comments. Let's take just a few minutes. I've covered quite a range of materials. I'm obviously struggling with some of these ideas myself, but what kinds of thoughts or questions on any of this? Are you getting some sense of how this ties together with the Hauerwas material, why I'm emphasizing this particular dynamic of the precedence of the indicative to the imperative? And any thoughts or questions? I'm sure it's not all clear. Vicki?
When God was giving the Ten Commandments, and I know you don't know what he was thinking, but was this in response to what they were doing at the bottom of the mountain, or did he have this plan to give Moses before Moses actually got up there? Because I think Moses was up there for several days, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think the general... Michal, can you help us on that? I've seen some interpretations suggesting that the Ten Commandments were more specifically related to Israel's disobedience, but I don't think that's the dominant interpretation. Can you help us with that?
Yeah, I don't think it is the dominant interpretation. In fact, if you read the scriptures closely, there were two different versions. The first is said to have been written by God, God's self, in God's own hand.
Right.
And that's considered to be almost a perfect ideal. And then when Moses came down and, in a sense, was confronting the real-life limitations of the people in the historical context with his ideal vision, there was a chasm. It wouldn't work. And when he saw what the people were doing, namely the golden calf, he smashed those tablets.
Right.
And when he goes back up to the mountains to get the second set, which is actually the second set that we see, we don't really know what the first one was, God speaks in Moses' right set, in Moses' hand. So that suggests that there might have been some difference or some concession, so to speak, to human limitations.
Right.
In the imperative voice, or in the law as we see it.
Right.
But the idea of there being Ten Commandments in some form definitely preceded the golden calf and what the people were doing. Moses was up there for 40 days and 40 nights and was talking with God that whole time. And it was actually only in response to Moses being absent for so long that the people started to panic.
Right.
And started to do the pagan rites.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Just another word why I've taken the time to try to establish this connection. It's my view that when ethics is done mainly in terms of rules and principles by themselves, that ethics are not terribly fruitful. It's my view that almost all of our better actions grow out of a particular kind of vision of the nature of reality. And that just as if a child is raised by parents where the child is always on trial and never experiences unconditional love, that child will feel insecure through most of his life. Rules will help, but there'll always be a certain uneasiness in the child's life. It's my sense that vision, how we view the world, is always primary in the moral life. That it's fine to have rules, and rules help us understand what justice demands and what good behavior towards others entails, but that the whole question of motivation, of why should I be moral anyway, why should I keep these rules, is primary. And what I'm suggesting here is that, rightly understood, the rules, or in this case, the Ten Commandments, are not constraints on liberty. They are precisely the expression of liberty. One of the early founding fathers in America, I don't know if it was John Adams or who, I forget for the moment, refers to those wise constraints that make men free. And the way I'm trying to present this is that moral rules, by being secondary to vision, express the kind of freedom that is possible. They are not, first of all, constraints on freedom. Now, this is a very, very different view of morality than many have. Many people see moral principles as antithetical to freedom. What I'm arguing is that moral principles flesh out, express, detail how it is possible to live when you're free. That you no longer have to steal other people's goods because you recognize that that's not the basis of your life. You don't have to steal your neighbor's wife. You don't have to slander your neighbor and cheat and lie because none of those things will establish your life at the deepest level. You are free not to do these things because you've seen a different vision of the way life is. And what I'm going to try to argue as the course goes on is that this is also true in relation to nature. That if nature is just a thing, a resource, something to be utilized and dominated and exploited, we will always have to have lots of rules and lots of lawyers and lots of courts. That the primary task involves learning to see nature and ourselves and perhaps God in a new way, so that our love of nature becomes the fundamental influence in how we treat nature. That if we can see nature as having intrinsic or inherent value, as being good and beautiful and worthwhile in itself, and not just to be exploited, that is about 90% of what is entailed in good behavior. But if you continue to see nature just as a resource, we're going to have an awfully lot of rules and a lot of policemen to enforce them. That's simplifying it. That's the drift that the course is going to take. Okay, our time is up.